you looked at Lexington's crime data for the last 20 years, is that it ebbs and flows a little bit, but we're still a very safe city. And I agree with Ray. I think the trick to this is going to be strong enforcement and lots of incarceration time for the people that aren't playing well with others.
Hmm. Okay.
You want to talk about this for a minute?
Sure, I'd love to.
David is the commander for the personal crimes unit at the, or division or whatever we call it, at the police department, which mm-hmm. includes all of this kind of stuff. And so
David Lyons.
Yeah, he's tuned into this sort of thing. But I will tell you, over the years, we have had police chiefs who have really not wanted to talk about gangs because they think that would scare people. Well, it should scare people. But the fact of the matter is we are seeing significant gang activity in our community. We're seeing shots fired calls going out regularly, and those shots fired calls go from one or two shots in the recent past to as many as 50 shots fired in a neighborhood. And so what's happened is the police department has identified maybe between 30 and 40 people who are responsible for almost all of this gun violence.
Really?
And what we have done is reinstituted a very successful program that we had in the past, and that was the ceasefire program. No social workers involved in this project. This is solely how can we identify these people, how can we catch them, and how can we incarcerate them. Our problem, Jack, and this has a significant part in this escalation of crime and seeming gun violence, and that is these wimpy sentencing laws that we have that discourage judges from incarcerating people. Get them out as quick as you can, and the criminals are, in my opinion, smarter than the legislators. They know what the limits are, and they're pushing the limits all the time. There's only one thing they understand that stops crime, and that's to incapacitate these thugs. And the way you do that is you incarcerate them. And because our citizens pay a lot of taxes and expect government to provide a safe, secure community. And the only way you can do that is identify these people that have chosen to do violent crimes and incarcerate them and protect us from them. So follow that one, Dan DeRue.
Yeah, I think we're well on our way. With ceasefire, that's something that we're real excited about because it's frustrating for the officers and the detectives when they finally get their hands on somebody that they know is a bad actor and is out hurting people or about to hurt people, to watch them turn around and come out of jail a little bit too quick. And I think most of the people in the community I work with are fed up with that as well.
If there's 40 people doing it, are they all drug or mostly, I don't mean drug, gang members or not?
A significant percentage of them are.
Are they?
Yeah. And, yeah. And Scott just finished talking about an attempt to get guns, and that was somebody tried to break into Bud's gun shop.
Last night, yeah.
Yeah.
Didn't get any.
They didn't get anything, but the thing that I hope if people that listen to us on this show keep guns in their cars, that they don't be stupid. Don't leave them in your cars because that's what these thugs do. They'll end up having people go break into cars and looking for guns, and then when they get guns, they give them to these people. And those things are the things we use. Now, this ceasefire project has taken a huge number of guns off the street. And I'll tell you a story, and I can't say any names.
Okay.
But recently, there was a very, very dangerous guy that had been in federal custody, and he was released. He served his sentence. And he's out. Federal conviction, a felon, and he was picked up very shortly after his release as a convicted felon in possession of a handgun. See?
Yeah.
And he went to jail, and they had some bond was set for $7,500. And within a couple of hours, one of his girlfriends shows up with $7,500 cash. He's on the street. That's concerning to us.
Yeah, no kidding.
You see, because he's out there, and he obviously knows how to get a hold of weapons, and we're very concerned about him, and that's the kind of problem that we run into, that ceasefire is trying to take care of.
That's good. All right, let's take a phone call here because I think we've got a gun question, I believe, for you. Ray, good morning.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, I wanted to respond to Mr. Larson's analogy, I guess, that everyone is in the same basket and they need to be incarcerated. And the word thug he uses so loosely, he's just not in tune with what's really happening in Lexington. I'm on the street, I know. He can quit all that thug stuff because everyone's not in the same category.
Okay, I got you. And I probably will hold off saying thugs for about 10 minutes.
Yeah.
See ya.
I asked Ray last week if he could put together a show about a new series, and thanks to Christy, she's given me a nice assessment of this thing. I started hearing from my friends, mainly under 40. It was almost all younger people. Of course, I think under 40 is a kid. My kid friends. About this new Netflix series called Making a Murderer. And I didn't know anything about it, but it's become very popular. It's not Downton Abbey popular, but it's become very popular. And just to give you a recap, like I say, Christy supplied me with this, and then we'll talk and ask, could you put together a show and talk about it? Because so many people are talking about it on the street. It's a series. It took 10 years to complete, and it begins with the introduction of a person named Stephen Avery. It takes place up in Wisconsin, 1985. Avery convicted of violently attacking a woman while she was out on a run. For 18 years, Avery stated that he was innocent and it wasn't him who committed the crime. It wasn't until the Wisconsin Innocence Project got involved that it was discovered that Avery was actually innocent. Once his innocence was discovered, he was released from prison. However, his troubles didn't end there. While Avery was pursuing a civil suit against the men and women who put him wrongfully behind bars for 18 years, he was arrested for a murder of a woman, a local photographer whose remains were found on Avery family property. Avery's 16-year-old nephew was also arrested for Teresa's murder. After a lengthy trial, Avery and his nephew were found guilty of murder and sentenced to life in prison. So I guess, and you guys can tell me, tell me who you brought, and then we'll talk about it.
Okay, first thing we have to say, Jack, is that we're going to talk about the whole series. And anybody, I finally have found out what spoiler alert means. That means you ruin the story.
We're going to tell the end.
Tell people the end.
Yeah.
So if you haven't listened to the whole thing and you don't want to know what happens, you probably ought to listen to something else this morning.
Yeah, for the next 30 minutes, anyway.
When Jack asked me to do this, I asked David Lyons, commander of the personal crimes part of the police department, to watch all of the series. And I also asked Paco Villalobos of our office, as a first-class prosecutor, to watch them.
Mm-hmm.
And so that we could have somebody that could discuss this thing knowledgeably,
mm-hmm.
from the police and the prosecution perspective. I also, Mary, of course, watches all this kind of stuff.
Mary Houlihan, your victim's rights office. Did you watch it because you wanted to, or did you watch it because Ray asked you to?
I watched it after we were here last week for your radio show, and the question kind of came up.
Yeah.
I, like you, had been hearing about it from so many people that I thought when I went home from that, well, I'll start listening.
Okay.
It hooked me.
All right. Did it hook you? Well, that's what everybody says. We'll go ahead and take a break. When we come back, we're going to tell you about it. And again, spoiler alert, we're going to tell you more than you want to know if you're a quote-unquote fan of this show. It's 20 minutes after 9 o'clock. And if you need a loan, there's no hassle at the castle, the biggest discounter of diamonds and fine jewelry. Here's the Belmac forecast. Rain developing, high temperature in the low 50s today. Tonight, rain changing to light snow showers, a low in the upper 20s. On Saturday, mostly cloudy with a chance of morning snow showers and a high in the mid-30s. And on Sunday, mostly cloudy with a chance of flurries and a high in the mid-20s. Right now, mostly cloudy, 46 at your official weather station. News Talk 590 WVLK. And FM 101.1. All right, this is something I don't think we've ever done this before. We're talking about a TV show this morning, and it's a show that has caught on Netflix, and it's a series, and it's a true crime series, and the name of it is Making a Murderer. If you're not watching it, you'll like the show, because apparently it's fascinating. We've got people in the studio who have watched it, But we're also going to give away the end of it. Is we keep giving these things because we don't want to make people mad at us, Ray. We're going to tell the whole story this morning. You've been in 4 true crime things. I think I've done 3.
Documentaries, yeah.
Yeah, and you said off the air, they all have an angle. It might not always be the same angle,
right?
But there's a reason for doing it. And so what's the reason for this one, you think?
Well, that's interesting because when somebody says it's a documentary, I go back to the ones that we've done, and they all do have some sort of agenda. And I have not watched this, so I'm kind of the ignorant one of the bunch again.
You and me.
Yeah. So, Paco, tell us a little bit about what this is all about.
Well, we asked the question about what the agenda is, and from the beginning of the series, it starts off with the exoneration of Stephen Avery, who's the defendant in this case. And it sort of sets you up for the sympathy toward him, thinking that maybe he's being framed later on when the murder occurs. And so when you go into the series, I think what people need to understand, first of all, is there is a slant. There is a theory being put out by the producers or the editors of the show to make you believe that he is innocent and he's being framed. And sort of every piece of evidence, every film montage, every interview is being done from that perspective and being tailored to that theory. I think what you get when you watch the series is you get a lot of interviews with the defense attorneys, with the family, Stephen Avery, and what you don't get is a lot of interviews with the police officers and the family members, which Mary might be able to talk about that more, but that's sort of what I found surprising is in all of this, what you lose is that there was a woman who was brutally murdered in this case, and that seems to be completely disregarded throughout the entire 10-hour series.
David Lyons, introduce us to Stephen Avery, because there may be a number of people listening that don't know anything about.
Right. According to the documentary, in the first episodes, it spends a little bit of time talking about who he is and that first conviction that was overturned on that rape.
He was convicted of what?
Of rape, a violent rape and assault.
Sexual assault, attempted murder, I think it was.
Exactly.
But he was sentenced, and he spent 18 years in prison. Mm-hmm. And that he was ultimately exonerated from that after spending 18 years in prison by DNA.
Correct.
Examination that the DNA that probably was found in the rape victim's vagina was not his.
Correct. It was a pubic hair. I think it's important to note, too, that that back when that happened, the DNA examination procedures were nowhere near available like they were later. Back when I used to work with you in homicides, DNA evidence has changed dramatically from the time that we were.
There was no DNA that we could use in 1986 when we tried LaFonda Faye Foster and Tina Powell. We had to do just traditional serology then.
Right.
Okay.
Another thing about Stephen Avery that's important that they start out with, too, is that that wasn't his only crime. He'd been in trouble with the law there before. And there was a burglary that he'd been convicted of. And I think that I was talking to Paco the other day, one of the first things that you witness as far as the slant and the side coming from the defendant's side on that is that the producers took a lot of time to mitigate the facts of that burglary that he was convicted of quite a bit, focusing on things like it was $14 and change or some beer to try to mitigate that. Well, that's a burglary, but that's not bad. He just took these things. And that was my first key, plus the dramatic music playing up in the background.
Sure, and when Paco said a minute ago they didn't look at the police side very much, I saw you look at Ray and do the...
Zero. I've watched all episodes, and there's if you see an interview with a police officer, it was done at a press conference or cross-examination.
Okay, all right, we're going to take a break, be right back. Very interesting, and we need to watch it, Ray. Then we'll do another show, because we'll be experts then, see? 253-5959, touch star 590 from AT&T, toll free from anywhere, 1-877-777-0590, or email jackpatty at wvlkam.com. And we're back. The name of the Netflix series is Making a Murderer, Ray.
Okay, let's, one of the things I want to make sure I have read about this series, and if you believe what you read, there is no mistake that there were significant shoddy police work, and there were some shoddy work by the prosecutor.
In the first case, right? In the rape case.
Yeah, what happens, I think, Paco, and you tell me about this, seems to me that the documentary, based on what I read, tries to take the sloppiness of the first case and say, obviously, the same players are involved, so it's probably the same thing.
Right. I think because of the specter of the exoneration from the first case, the filmmakers of the series, along with the defense attorneys in the Stephen Avery second trial in the murder case, really use that exoneration to promote their theory that there's this giant conspiracy against Stephen Avery by the police department trying to go after him, either for the lawsuit or because of whatever happened in the first case. And really, I think in talking about the case with other people, in my opinion, it feels as if the police in the first exoneration case was more sloppy work to begin with. And then when they realized it was sloppy work, tried to double up or back up, and that's what really got them in trouble. But the show tries to paint it out to be deliberate action as far as this conspiracy that apparently, and the way it promotes it is, it's the police department, it's the judge, it's the witnesses. At one point, I think there's even implied that the FBI is somehow involved in it. And it gets sort of almost out of control at one point to where it doesn't become believable anymore.
David, talk to you. You said you wanted to make sure that we said that there was police issues and prosecutor issues. So talk a little bit about it.
Yeah, I think that's important. When this came to my attention, Lieutenant Matt Brotherton, who works with me in the special victim section, came to me with this and talked about that. And that's where Matt came from. It was, as you watch it, that you see the errors in it. And there were errors, and some of them, I think, were worse than others. But either way, they are part of what builds this impression of the conspiracy that Pockel talked about.
Was it not handling evidence properly, or what?
Things like that, and some of them were small. I think in the first one on exoneration is that it looks like they clearly failed to examine a suspect they should have examined, and that's criticism they just have to take on that, is that there was the person that they ended up, I think, convicting, and is somebody that was in their sights, and they mm-hmm. sure looked. And then on the other one, on the murder investigation, there's glaring things that we looked at that the sheriff's department that was involved in the first one facing a lawsuit for some reason participated in a major search warrant operation on the property and probably never should have set foot on that property.
Really?
Only for the idea of the impression that it would cast and the rebuilding that the prosecutor would have to use, too. And another thing, too, is the dissemination of information that me and Pockel talked about is that on the prosecution and the police side is that they were talking way too much. That's important here because in this town, I know that people get frustrated and the media gets frustrated. We charge in a murder here. We basically clam up, and we always have. I've been here 23 years, and we do that to make sure that there's going to be a fair trial after that. It's not about this isn't for First 48. This isn't a real-time crime drama. This is people's lives and victims that have to be taken care of.
This is Linda. Linda, good morning.
Yes, I've been watching this, and I'm on my third episode,
yeah.
And I love this kind of thing, this investigation. But I was watching last night, and the police were interviewing this guy's nephew, and clearly that young man did not understand what they were asking. Clearly, he was impaired as far as mental faculties. And that interview was just so poorly done from my perspective, and I know very little about the police except what I see on TV. And he was clearly made to confess that, and I don't understand why the police would have done that. Can you show some light on that?
Yeah, I've watched the same thing, and it looks that way. And I think that what you have to look at is, Ian, this is coming from a defense standpoint when they produce that. When you conduct an interview, even if you conduct an interview with somebody that you could suspect has a challenge or something, you're still going to make a record. And keep in mind, they made recorded records and video records of that, so it's not like they had anything to hide. And I've talked to other friends about this, too, is those interviews and those statements no doubt went through suppression hearings and challenges all the way up to trial and were upheld. And the last thing I'll say when people say it looks like he was made to confess, when you're interviewing people in a case, we have a lot of latitude on the styles and the personalities that we can take forward to try to get to the truth in a statement. And that's what we're looking for, is the truth in what happened.
David.
Did his mother have been? I mean, he was 16 years old and handicapped, clearly. Shouldn't his mother or an attorney been in there with him?
You're on the third episode. I'm going to tell you to keep watching, and you'll get that question answered. I won't do a spoiler on you on that.
Okay.
But that's resolved for the caller's purpose. That was resolved.
Thank you, Linda. Tyler apparently is watching, too. Tyler, good morning.
Yes, I just had a quick question. I've already actually watched the entire series.
Okay.
But, you know, listening to you guys chat about it, you said that the movie itself was played up to kind of play off of the first case and create conspiracy theories for the second.
Yeah.
My question is, you know, as a DA and as a group of guys at what you do, how could you feasibly try a case that where there's no blood in the guy's house, there's no blood in the guy's garage, there's no markings on the bed where he tied the girl up, there's nothing to solidify him being there for the crime? So I can understand where you're saying conspiracy, but my thing is, if you've watched the whole entire series, the self-appointed DA made the guy, his nephew, sign a fake statement and called the guys to come and arrest him after he coerced him into drawing a verbatim statement. So that's not necessarily a conspiracy. My question for you is, let's look at what they missed. Let's look at the evidence that they missed, and what is your opinion about everything that they missed?
All right.
That's my question.
Okay.
Well, one thing I think is important to realize in this case is that at the end of the day, there were 12 jurors who looked at this case and decided beyond a reasonable doubt that they believed him to be guilty. And it's hard to get 12 people to agree on anything, much less beyond a reasonable doubt. And when you look at this case, and after doing research beyond just what the film shows, there are clearly facts in this case and that trial that were presented to those jurors that you don't get to see in the documentary. I think one of the issues they brought up with the fact that there was DNA from Stephen Avery discovered underneath the hood of the vehicle, I think from his sweat. And I think there's a part of the interview with the nephew where he discusses Stephen Avery lifting up the hood of the vehicle as well. Well, that doesn't come in. You don't get to hear that in a documentary. And how would he know that unless he was either there or a participant in the crime itself? I think the other thing to remember, too, is that I don't believe that they actually went to the house to search the home until days after the disappearance. I think that's correct. Enough time to hide any type of evidence that there might be. I think there was another piece of evidence about a gun that was on top of the headboard as well. So,
okay. David, you mentioned something.
Thanks, Tyler.
About the appearance of the nephew at trial.
Right. It was my impression whenever he was cross-examined at trial that this impression people have that he was challenged disappeared a little bit. That was my impression.
Is that right?
Right. Is that he was focused and answered articulately much more than you see. So we can talk more about that.
Yep, we're taking a break. 253-5959, touch star 590 from AT&T, toll free from anywhere, 1-877-777-0590, or email jackpatty@wvlkam.com. We'll do this, we just decided we won't do this next week, but we'll do this subject on this thing again. Obviously, there's a lot of interest. And here's an email, Ray, that came in during the break. Said it's from Lisa. Says, please consider doing a show on the murder of Jamie Stice by Kathy Coy in Bowling Green in 2011. Miss Coy cut Miss Stice's baby from her body, killing her, and portrayed on IDTV this week. If you've already covered this case, which I think we have, but it's been a long time ago, I would enjoy listening. So I'll give you that suggestion, Ray. We've got about 5 minutes left, and I don't know, do we want to give away the end of the thing on this time if we're going to do it again? It's completely your call.
No.
Okay.
What we want to do is we want people to pay attention to this show and to be prepared to talk to us in 2 weeks.
Okay.
When we'll come back and finish talking about it. So, Paco, you were saying something off the air about burden of proof and one of the frustrations you have about this documentary.
Well, what I was talking about earlier is, and I made the comment, one, when we go into trial, we talk about shows like CSI and Law and Order, and I think in the back of the mind, people understand those shows aren't real. They're not an actual depiction of how the legal system works. This documentary purports itself to be real, and I think a lot of people buy into that when it's not. It is also a story, just from a different point of view. And the problem that I had with the whole burden of proof is that prosecutor has a burden of proof. If we're going to put a theory out there, if this is what happened, we've got to prove it. The defense doesn't have that burden. And so what you see in this documentary is the defense and even the filmmakers putting out a version of what they believe happened, the conspiracy, and don't really have to back it up. And you're only getting one side of that and not getting all the facts that were actually released at weeks of trial that get condensed down to 2 hours.
You admitted some shoddy police and prosecutorial work in the first trial. Was there some shoddy stuff going on in the second, the murder trial?
I think the things that were there were they opened themselves up to perceptions, like when they went along with that search warrant and things like
that. Yeah, okay. So yes.
It could have been avoided maybe. And that way you wouldn't even have that perception.
Mary, people watch these kind of things and they assume that that's the norm.
Yeah, that's what bothers me about it, not only because that is not what I see day in and day out working with the prosecution and police in our town. I've seen different things that have brought me concerns on cases. I mean, there's no perfect case, but I know where to go to bring attention to that. I know who I can talk to. I know that the police will respond and look into an issue if I run into one. And from my perspective, the issues that I run into are those presented to me by crime victims. And like Paco already mentioned, that's the element of this case that was left completely out, or this docudrama. And it is so frustrating to realize how few things come from the victim's perspective. And in this, you know, that's who I really feel for, is the victim. And really what this docudrama is doing to that victim's family, to think that you suffer such a loss and then have it be spread all over the country and be the thing that everybody suddenly has their quarterback opinion, you know, Monday quarterback opinion, mm-hmm. or I'm not a football person, whatever.
Armchair
day
quarterback.
That is,
yeah, no, exactly. I know what you mean.
But, you know, that's who I think of when I look at these shows. And then I hate that something that, you know, garners this much attention and becomes so, you know, publicly digestible and with people that really don't even understand the criminal justice system. Come down, watch a trial. Look at what the prosecution has to go through to ever get somebody put behind bars. Any crime victims out there listening right now know exactly what I'm talking about. Every single case I walk through with a crime victim means that I am giving them a lot of bad news about the realities of the nightmare they're about to experience.
Mm-hmm. And we're done.
Okay, well, we'll see you next week, but in 2 weeks, we'll invite Paco and David Lyons and Mary back. And
any of the three of which I think could take Nancy Grace's place in a heartbeat.
Well, they don't shriek.
Not shoes we're looking to fill.
Stand by. We have an update from the Information Center live with Lee's next. Have a great weekend. I'll be back Monday morning at 6, 5 Central.